Okay.
Yes? Yes.
I'm on air. Good evening, everyone. One whole day of talks and meditation and hand peeling that wasn't expected by anyone. Do you still feel your hands? Is it still lingering? For me, it usually does linger quite a while. I do have one question first. Rob was asking me, there was one lady who lost her key, if she could make herself known to him by tomorrow. And also about the gentle yoga this morning, it wasn't quite clear. I did come back to check and I saw that the yoga was happening, but with the timing there as well. So if the back room there could please be left free in the morning when the gentle yoga is happening, so that they can have their session in there. That is at, what was it? That will be Sunday. Here, from 6:15 onwards. So we can sit here in the hall from 5:30 to 6:15. Technically, you can carry on sitting here and using those two halls if you want, but of course there will be a bit of talking in the back there. So, I don't know, maybe sit in your cottage or sit outside. Might be a bit too cold outside though. Anyway, yeah, I mean, if you're comfortable in here and you're not disturbed by it, that's fine. It would just be nice that they have that location to use for that at that time. Good. I think that's all I can think of. So we have a tradition here that we usually do Q&A at nighttime. And when Ajahn Brahm is leading the retreats, that's always a bit of a opportunity for him to lighten things up and have a bit of fun and games. So we'll see how we go. He's very, very skilled with that kind of stuff. And Venerable Junda will be helping me with that. We usually just kind of pass it back and forth and see where it goes. We have a few to go through. So let's see what there is in the basket. Do relationships, meaning husband-wives, are karmic? Oh. If so, why we repeat the same pattern again and again? Thanks. Okay. Let me think about that. Are they karmic? They can be. I've heard of cases where people have met each other again, like kind of like next lifetime. And also there is, what was it? There is one of those stories where they say when people are really, really close to each other, that there is a very high likelihood that when they do get both reborn in the human plane again, that they will find each other. It's often, I mean, this is just talking about relationships here now, but even with children, that's one case I know a bit more about, and we just had a recent case with a Sri Lankan family. They had a son with a heart defect. And unfortunately, that son, because the heart defect was quite strong, and it actually was a slight heart defect, but because they didn't know, he died. And then a boy was born shortly after that and had exactly the same heart defect. But this time they found it earlier and had exactly the same doctor in the same ward, and even the parents, they kind of had an inkling. So one they were called very, very similarly. His name was Manu. I can remember the Manu now. I don't know what the person was in his last life. So it does tend to happen that we are attracted or that we look for the same people again, if we do have the karmic conditions for it, actually, yes. But with karma, it's kind of like, Ajahn says there's like two parts to it. One is wishing to get reborn somewhere. That's like wishing to fly to Hawaii. Now the question is, do you have enough money in the bank to fly to Hawaii? So there's two conditions that have to be met there. That's what comes to mind. What do you think, Chunda? Venerable Chunda.
Well, the Buddha say, if a couple in their past life, they keep the same sila, I mean keep the five precepts, and they come to the monastery together and offer dana to the monastic, there's very high chance they'll meet again. So that's what the Buddha say. If they have good virtue and they make merit in the monastery or with the Sangha. Going back to the story with the kids, there's also another story on the internet. You can check online, it's quite true. I came across it when I was looking through the internet. There was, with kids, if they do pass away, most likely they come back to the same family. There's a famous case where there was a family driving and they have a car accident. So in the back of the vehicle, there was two girls and one boy. So I think they maybe one was about two, one was four and one was seven, roughly like that. But all the three kids pass away and die. So the parents was quite sad and quite upset. So after 1 year, the parents decide to have another family. So when she fell pregnant, she gave birth to triplets. And guess what happened? When the triplets was born, it was two girls and one boy. So the three child that passed away in the car accident, they all came back. So that's a very strong karmic connection. So with kids, the normally, with the kids, with small children, their mind is so pure. They're not tainted by defilements. So when they pass away, usually they're inclined to come back to the same family. So that's one case I heard of. You can look at the internet. The family is called the Kobe family.
Okay. yep. How can I deepen my meditation? Is it simply practice and time? Your turn first. We always go back and forth.
I think with meditation practice, you see the more we practice, the more we become skilled to meditation, then depends. Some people, if they work a job that's not too stressful, it's easy to let go. And if we have a happier mind state, if we come to a retreat like this, or stay in the monastery, or keep the eight precepts, then it gives the condition to develop deeper meditation easily. Not most of the time, but sometimes. Sometimes that is possible. Because meditation is just basically learning to let things go. And meditation is quite important because we take a shower when we are quite filthy. So same with the mind. So if we don't meditate, it's like not taking a shower for a few days. So we start to smell, and people don't be around us. So some of the senior monks are saying that meditation is like cleaning the mind, so we must do that. The more we clean the mind, the more the mind become more pure. Okay, thank you.
Any question? Well, we were just talking about it during the interviews, and one of the quotes kind of came up from Ajahn Chah, and he was saying, if you let go a little, you get a little peace. If you let go a lot, you get a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you get complete peace. Okay. Dear Bhante, thank you for your wonderfully clear and entertaining talks. Okay, very good. The KM retreats give a very friendly entry into mindfulness and meditation. I hope BSWA can offer more of these style of retreats to help introduce people new to meditation, this beautiful path of freedom. Sure, I'm very happy to pass that on. We had one in April, and this is now the second one. It's already getting a bit tight, though, with a lot of retreats these days. And we're very grateful that NIM And Anusha and also Rob and Visakha have put their hand up to help with these retreats, because Bianca is doing all the other BSWA retreats and she's also not getting younger. And it is a lot of work that goes into these retreats. So, but yeah, I'll definitely pass that on. And if we have the opportunity, I don't see why not. We have a monk factory across the road, so there's enough raw material there to test the new models. anything to add? No. Sure.
Hopefully the next few years we'll have a few branch monasteries getting set up. There's one already in Camp Scott, the Cambodian temple. We got just bought a new property, 27 acres next door. Mm. So that will expand to maybe about 5 to 8 kutis. Then one of the monk is working as in Albany now, working on with the council to plans on setting up a monastery down in Albany.
I did actually see with the applications on some stage that two people came from Albany. Did they actually make it to the retreat? Are they here?
Yeah.
Yeah, wow, wonderful. Yes, nice. So there's something happening down there.
and myself and Bhante Bodhidatta will be going to Melbourne in January. Myself, I've been supporting a monastery in Newbury for the last 3 years. So I'll be going back there to hopefully to finish off the monastery. Yeah? But Ajahn Brahm says monastery never finishes. Yeah?
finish off the building work. finish off the monastery. Sounds funny.
Yes, so hopefully, I mean, what happened was we went there to support a new community because they were struggling. When I went there, there was only about a few monastic, maybe 2 or 3 monastic, and they were getting overworked and a bit burnout. So I went there to support one of the senior monks, and later on he resigned and went back to lay life. So I got stuck with the project down there. Then I was only 4 reigns, so I said, oh, no, this is not very good. So I did ask Ajahn Brahm if some of the monks can come over and support that project and get the monastery finished and completed so we can come back and retire and come back to the main monastery. But the community there, the monastic and also the VSV committee and the lay people are so happy. They basically want us there permanently. So most likely we'll make Newbury Monastery a Brass Monastery of Bodhidharma. So that's in the plan for the next 5 years. The plan is to have a place for nuns, for monks, and also for a lay center. More like 3-in-1. A monk's monastery, a bhikkhuni monastery, and also a lay center. So once it's completed, we may have up to about 60 people staying there. So the size of this community now. And I don't think I want to be in charge of the monastery that size. So I told Ajahn Brahm, I'll just get the job finished. Yeah? And hopefully other senior monks can take over. Thank you.
But they have quite a good community down there. They're actually the second oldest Buddhist community in Australia. And they have a teens group and what is it, Dhamma school,
yes,
and young adults. And they're really active there as well. Mm. Okay, Can you please discuss the 8 precepts of Buddhism? Well, we were just talking about that. Well, maybe I break the news to you now. I was planning to break the news to you on tomorrow. But the 5 sessions I'm actually doing are about the 5 precepts, but they're framed in a different way. So I'm talking about the positive aspects of the precepts. Instead of saying, don't do this, don't do that, I'm trying to encourage you to do the opposite. So we're already working through the 5 precepts, and I will be mentioning them on the last session in a bit more detail. So that's the normal kind of morality that we are encouraged to keep by the Buddha as a protection for ourselves and as, basically a little bit also like an insurance policy or whatever, that will make sure we are taken care of and we are continuing in a nice way into the future. When we take the 8 precepts, the additional precepts are more about restraint than about being moral. And restraint is about renunciation, about simplicity, and about contentment. So those precepts are there to cut down on things, but not to inconvenience us, but as I was saying in the beginning, to help us along with the practice. So one of them is not eating in the afternoon. That is taken by lay people usually during retreats. I already talked about that. And that's what the monastics keep all the time. Then there is another precept that tells us not to go to like shows and entertainments and these kind of things, to kind of go out and entertain our minds. And there is one more, which has to do with beautification. So we don't beautify our bodies. We don't kind of wear jewelry when we are keeping those eight precepts, because again, just to keep it simple, and in meditation, we are looking inward. So we don't really have to kind of, you know, represent our body to the outside world. In some of the retreats, we were just talking about it, people are not even kind of allowed to look at each other. It's kind of part of the practice. And we feel here it's nice to keep it natural and to just be friendly, to not get caught up in a conversation if you don't want to, but to, you know, look at people as you would normally look at them and to kind of share a smile, because it's something which uplifts you and which uplifts the other people as well and helps with the practice in the end. So I think I've kind of covered that. Is that right? Anything else to add? All good? Cool. Okay. Ooh, long one. Your one. If you are doing the best to cultivate your soil with all the right things, as we discussed, and make the right conditions to grow the seeds, what should we do about weeds? Oh, yes. Especially when the weeds are people and we are supposed to be compassionate and show what we are supposed to. I like that. And to be compassionate and show loving kindness. For example, if someone close to you engages in non-wholesome, unwholesome, actions, or is always in those negative cycles, is it okay to out them? What? Out them out and throw them in the bin? Ooh. Or do we have to tolerate them? Oh, okay. I'll be talking a little bit more about that as well, but please, take it away. Tomorrow.
Okay, that's quite a good question.
It's live for you.
Okay. So with any community, sometimes there's a lot of pressure. Okay, so this is quite recent. So when the senior monk in Victoria, the new monastery, he was under a lot of pressure. So he resigned after 1.5 years of setting up and running the monastery. One reason is that there was a lot of people that was basically in conflict with him. So when he left, I took over. I told myself, oh, I'll go get it next. But the good thing about staying in Bodhiyana Monastery, you see how Ajahn Brown operates. He has a lot of loving kindness, compassion and metta towards people. And I've seen monks and also lay people give Ajahn Brown a hard time. And he would deal with it very skillfully. He will always encourage the good qualities and forgive people for their mistake. But they're just human beings. So when the senior monks left, so I took over Newbury Monastery. So it's the same problem. I have problem with the monks. We have a lot of junior monks there that will come and go, maybe up to two. Then we have junior nuns too, and a lot of lay people coming to support the monastery. And some of them, they come into the monastery quite rough. They have a hard lifestyle, quite tough upbringing. So sometimes when I'm in charge, they see me as a person that's in control, authority person. So if things go wrong, they'll blame me for everything that's going wrong in the monastery or in their life. So one thing I have to learn to do is basically, no matter what happened, look at the good qualities. And don't look at all the, we say, weeds or problems. Because we all human beings. We all trying our best. So when they're having a hard time, when they scream and shout at me, yeah, I just forgive them. Because they're hurting inside. Yeah. Then later on, when I don't react, they found that I have the good intention. And because I have a good intention for their own mental well-being, yeah, because in a small community, the last thing I want to do is be strict. And I end up everyone leaving. Yeah, and I might be the only monk there. Because when that monastery started, it was quite a full community. And due to the conflict, a lot of people left. So I told myself, I'm not going to follow that footstep again. So no matter how tough it is, I will basically forgive people and look at the good qualities. Because with any new monastery, like Bodhiyana Monastery, Ajahn Brown is not the first abbot. Ajahn Jagaro was the first abbot. So he's working very hard. So later on, he got burned out and he disrobed. Same with the monastery in, I think, Wat Buddha Dhamma. There was, I'm not going to mention his name, but he started a monastery, and he got burned out too and left. So with new community, you see whoever is in charge, they have to deal with a lot of problems and difficulty with people. So one great advantage or blessing of being with Ajahn Brown is to see how he operates. He does have a lot of kindness. He does give a lot of forgiveness. But also he forgive himself for the mistake that he made. So same with myself. I'm a very young monk. I only have 4 wasam. I took over Newbury Monastery. You see, the Buddhists say you should not run a monastery until you actually become fully enlightened or 10 years in robe. Yep. So I took over my 4 years in robe. So I told myself, this is the end of me. But I say, no, it's fine. I just have a break. I come back and a break every 6 months. Come back to Bodhiyana, have a break. So when I come back, the monks noticed I was quite grumpy. But after 2 weeks or a month, I become more relaxed. They saw me, I become more happier. So I was just basically letting some steam, letting go some steam. So it's tough, I admit, getting shouted and abused and put down, especially trying to get a monastery established. Now the monastery is doing very well, and we have a full community. So when myself and Bodhidharma is back there, the place is full. We have a lot of people staying there. People are staying in the library. So it's good. I find that sometimes being a Buddhist monk, we have to live by example. To set an example is basically live from loving kindness and compassion. It's very important because monastic and lay people, we all are very smart. When we see people's behavior, their speech and their action, we know where they're coming from. So as a monastic, we really have to set a good example. Because if we don't set a good example, people don't trust us. Because we might talk the talk, but we have to walk the talk. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, Ajahn has this beautiful quote that stayed with me. He says, "Water the flower. Flowers don't water the weeds." And when you think about it a little bit more, the water, now as I've presented, is kind of the relationship, but the water is basically our attention. And as Venerable Chunda was saying correctly, it is the question where we are putting our attention. And if we're putting our attention on the good things, they will grow and they will gain strength. And then there will come a time when those weeds wither away all by themselves, or they're at such a state so it's easy to take them out. But what happens sometimes is that we are trying, as it sounds a little bit in this note, to throw away people or whatever, bin them, to pull out the weed. But the pulling out is an unwholesome mind state. So we're trying to get rid of an unwholesome mind state with an unwholesome mind state. And that unfortunately just feeds it. And the weeds will keep growing. So there is different ways of dealing with it, but Ajahn Brahm really emphasizes, and also the Buddha very often, to focus on the good things and to let them grow. So I've always mentioned those other cycles as well so that we are aware of it, but we try not to pay too much attention to it unless we're really caught in it. And when we're caught in it, then there's many different ways of dealing with it. But yeah, that really depends on what it is. Good. How long does it take to reach a point in your meditation when everything just clicks and the initial resistance to doing the practice dissipates? It can happen any moment. How long does it take? I don't know, that long. It's just, you can't tell because you don't know the conditions that we bring with ourselves from past lives. You don't know the conditions that are in place, and they come together with other conditions, like coming to a retreat for the first time, and bang, it just clicks. Very often that is actually what happens. And, well, then that is kind of the experience that will draw you back to the practice, even if you do stop. The deeper those states are, the more impact they have on you. So Ajahn talks about positive trauma in that respect. Trauma is something that haunts us in our dreams, that we relive again and again, and that we don't want to relive. But it can happen with positive things as well. If something clicks, you just can't undo it. You just kind of keep being drawn back to it. And you end up wearing robes on some stage, maybe, or whatever it is. Yeah. So, I don't know. Hope that answers the question. Anything to add?
No.
Okay, good. Your turn. Is no expectations the same as no hope? No. What do you have to say?
I think sometimes if we expect too much, we may get disappointed. Sometimes it's good not to expect too much and have more hope in a way that when hoping for the best, but don't expect too much. Optimistic, yep.
Oh, optimistic, okay, yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's good to expect. Like for me, I was expecting things to do. Like, when I first came to Bodhiyana Monastery, I was expecting basically everyone to be enlightened. And when after our day, I realized, well, that's not the case. I was expecting everyone to be having good meditation and to be very pure-hearted. Then, oh, that's not the case too. Yeah, I mean, there are some very good practitioners, but there's very few of them. So when I lower my expectation, I did not get disappointed too much. Sometimes if we expect too much, we will be quite disappointed. The other thing that I did not expect it was lay people. Because sometimes when we have interviews, we sit down next to Ajahn Brahm as the Upata, then we listen to our lay supporters that come in and do retreats. And quite a lot of them have very good experience. Like some of them are getting to like the jhanas, some can remember past life, some can have very amazing experience, like they can see other beings in other existence. That I did not expect it. Because I thought all this state, yeah, only monks can have it. But the more I stay in Rome, the more lay people I met, I realized there are some lay people out there that's been practicing for like 10 or 20 years, and some of them have better practice than monastic. But these beings, these are people out there, they have a very pure heart. It's like they're like a deva or heavenly beings in this world. Because their heart is so pure, and they have a lot of compassion and very generous. And when they sit down and meditate, their mind can go very deep. So deep that their mind become very bright and radiant. And sometimes they can get into jhanas. So the Buddha say, when the Buddha become fully enlightened, the Buddha say, it'll be very hard for him to teach anyone in this world. No one will understand. One of his friends that was a monk with him came and begged the Buddha three times to teach the Dharma. And the Buddha said, this Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path is so hard to understand. There'll be very few people that will understand it. But his friend told him, there'll be beings with little dust in their eyes. And if you teach them the Dharma, they will understand. So the longer I stay in Rome, the more I realize there are very good monks out there, very few of them. But there's a lot of lay people that have very good heart and good practice and have very little dust in their eyes. So that's something that I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think expectation is kind of bound up with expecting something. And hope is more like an encouragement. So they're quite different in nature. So with expectation, we aim very, very high and we get disappointed very often. With hope, we kind of start at the good enough level and we work our way towards as high as is possible. So no hope would be hopelessness and freezing. And that's one of those things that we try to avoid. We try to stay flexible, we try to stay open and have hope. But like with faith, don't have blind faith, blind hope. Actually start to build it up so it becomes confidence, trust, and goes all the way.
Okay, ooh, may I have to
hurry up a bit. Is there any benefit to meditating lying down rather than sitting? Or is this not recommended? Okay. meditation is not about posture, but as I was saying, it is helpful. The lying down posture kind of is the program for the body to say, okay, sleep time. So that's what your mind very often will do. But of course, you might be lying in a hospital bed or, just whatever the situation is. And then it's recommended to just kind of lie down in a slightly different posture. So you kind of signal to your body, I'm lying down now, I'm relaxing. But it's not sleep time, okay? It's meditation time. But it's not. Yeah, I don't know. Ajahn just said, if you lie down, don't lie down close to your pillow, because it has a magnetic force. Something like that. Yeah. But try it out. If it works. But we don't care how those states come about, if lying down is how it's functioning for you. But usually an upright posture brings another flow of energy. And also I feel it brings a different way of being grounded. So when you're sitting on a chair, it's always nice to have your feet on something and just feel that groundedness. And this posture, we're not used to it as Westerners very often, but it is actually very, very grounded. Especially also if you do the whole lotus, the full lotus, it has those three points and it's very, very stable. Yeah, but don't force your body to do anything it's not made to or which doesn't work for it.
I think if you do try lying down, It's always good to sit first. Once your sitting meditation is quite stable and quite deeper, then you can transfer to lying down easily. Yeah? Because sometimes I find that if someone is got injury on the leg or they're very tired, lying down is actually a good way to meditate. But sometimes the reason why I say it is because after going to Melbourne and working in the morning, afternoon, night, and walking long hours, I'm so tired that the only time I can practice is when I lie down and for 10 minutes before I go to sleep. So lying is good. Sometimes when you're really tired and you sit down, you become quite drowsy. You nod a lot. Then I find just lying down completely still and just closing your eye and just relaxing and letting go, become very calm and peaceful for 10 minutes is quite good. You get a lot of energy and a lot of happiness and joy back from one's practice. But coming back to Bodhiyana, I still a bit of lying and I find that the disadvantage after that is once your meditation goes quite deep, it's very hard to sleep because you get a lot of energy.
I was just going to say. Yeah.
And if you get very good at lying down, it could be quite annoying, where you can't sleep at night.
People have that experience. It's actually quite common on longer retreats that they go to bed and they're like, oh, I had a whole day of meditation. I really want to rest now. And the mind is just so bright and just wouldn't let you sleep. But it's fine. It's okay.
Yes. So lying does work, but it's good to practice sitting down first. Once you're very good at sitting, and when you're really tired, you can't sit down, then just lie down and just make your mind peaceful.
Another one for you. How can black hole man be more grateful for his crappy job? we like questions like that. The video?
The video.
Did you watch it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's your turn. How can black hole man be more grateful for his job? A crappy job. Well, who says it's a crappy job? It's just the copying machine doesn't work. Blame the copy machine. If they would have a Kyoshira 2050, everyone would be happy and dancing in the office. I don't know.
I mean, I work in many places before I ordained as a monastic. And I do find that sometimes who we work around is quite important. Mm. If we work with people that are quite intense and quite unhappy and complain a lot, then you really have to take care of your own practice. There's one place where I was working before I ordained as a monastic. Was basically paying off my debt and saving a bit of money for my parents before I went and spent 1 year in the monastery just to test things out. And that place where I was working, everyone was basically unhappy there. I mean, they're only there because the money is okay. But it was quite a dangerous place to work. Like, when I was there, I heard of people getting their finger crushed and their stomach cut open because it's quite a dangerous environment. Because they're working with very sharp metal sheets. And sometimes when there's a lack of mindfulness, people get hurt or injured. So I noticed at that workplace, people are not happy. They complain a lot and they don't want to be there. But it's just a job. So for myself, I really have to take care of myself. So the good thing about being a Buddhist for 11 years before joining the monastery was I learned how to practice mindfulness, wash my mind very carefully. So when I start to become a bit negative, during my lunch break, I'll sit in my car and meditate for 10 or 15 minutes just to allow that the positive mindset to arise. So once the mindfulness is quite is there and quite relaxed, then I go back to work and take care of, be very mindful of what I'm doing. So before I left the workplace to join the monastery, my supervisor will ask me, Why are you leaving? Please stay here because the company will increase the pay in the future, maybe next year. I say that I pay off my debt already, and I'm going to take 1 year off and move out to the monastery and practice for 1 year. So he was quite sad to see me go. But he told me something quite interesting. He told me that everyone that he worked with, that he found that I was quite relaxed. I was quite peaceful. And basically quite happy, and did not complain so much. So I was thinking, interesting. Why I say that? That I realized because I was quite mindful of my feeling and my tension in my body and my stress level. So I always maintain a positive mind state. So in order doing practicing mindfulness every moment, it made me a more productive worker. So my supervisor will put me into any machine and I always manage to increase the production of the material. But also I was quite relaxed. So when I relax, I can basically be very mindful at the work that I'm doing. Because I realize where I'm working, a lot of people got injured before. So I was quite mindful. And because I was mindful, my supervisor also picked that up. And he told me that because I was quite calm and peaceful, he actually made him quite relaxed and peaceful too. So that's why, like everyone here, and sometimes we have like our retreatants when they go back home, their workplace or family or friends will say that when you come back from a retreat, you're actually quite relaxed and happier. So, yeah, so sometimes when we go for a retreat or we stay in the monastery and we develop a calm and peaceful mind and develop loving kindness, and we go back, people that we stay with, our workplace, our friends, they will notice the change in our mind.
I also thought of suggesting just to find some meaning and purpose, even if it's a crappy job. I'm pretty sure there will be some things in your workplace. I mean, I don't know for the black hole man, but that will inspire you and that will give you the energy to do the work that you're doing. And if that inspiration is really lacking there, if that purpose is really lacking there, to maybe see if there is something out there which you can change in your workplace or even, you know, changing the workplace to do something which is more meaningful, because we're spending a lot of time in our workplaces. So it would be nice to, yeah, bring happiness into that place and also have happiness arise from that place. How does one deal with a questioning mind and self-doubt? Woohoo. One thing with questions is that they never end. There's quite a few in there still. No, that's actually how it works. You might remember when your children, I used to be a primary school teacher, when the children kind of reach a certain age, they just have this, and then what? And then you give them an answer and they say, yeah, but why is this like that? And okay, then you give them an answer and it just keeps going on and on and on and on. It's just no end to it. And that's what tends to happen with questions. They never really cut to the core. They never really touch where we're trying to get at with the question. Questions are always about something. But feelings are things that are much more immediate, and wisdom is also something, but that arises in stillness. It doesn't arise in this kind of endless circling around things. And self-doubt. Yeah, it happens. Yeah, but just slowly, slowly, step by step, start building it up. Have hope, have faith, start to gain the confidence, and then it just moves deeper and deeper in that area, and then the doubt just disappears. But I don't think you can address doubt with asking questions, really. It's okay to ask questions, but allow yourself to be open and to see what arises when you go into stillness, or when you just kind of put a question in the back of your mind. Or there's this one story of one lady that was working very, very hard before a 9-day retreat, and she was in a high-end job and she had so many problems. And she came to the retreat, dropped everything. She came actually late, but dropped everything. And through that period of just dropping all the things, suddenly during a retreat, a solution came up to a problem that she was thinking about just for such a long time. And I think that's where creativity can really happen. Creativity happens when there is not just doing, when we allow ourselves to just be receptive and let the ideas come to us. That's kind of what comes to me at the moment. Anything to add?
Yeah, self-doubt is one of the hindrances to deep meditation. I mean, sometimes the best thing to do is try it out. The more we try, then we'll improve. Like, even myself going to Melbourne, I have a lot of doubt. But I just keep going, keep trying. And things turn out better than what I expected. So sometimes too much doubting is not healthy. So sometimes it's good to take a chance, have a bit of faith, and just try, wait and see how things turn out. Because sometimes we don't know until we try. If we have too much doubt, then the worst thing is never trying. So if we did try and things don't work out, never mind, we do something else.
And also one thing that I haven't mentioned, I mentioned it in the personal interviews, but we've kind of talked about quite often that we can't think ourselves into meditation, and that we can just feel ourselves into meditation. But sometimes the bridge there is, or the gap there is just too huge to bridge. And the thing that is lying between those two things is imagination that we talked about before. Imagination can be something really, really helpful if we imagine the positive, if we imagine in the right way, if we stretch ourselves into the right direction. Okay, we're slowly getting there. Oh, thank you. That is the most important thing to take into a... What? Thank you. Okay, what is the most important thing to take into a daily meditation sitting? Your one, is it? Yeah.
One of the most important thing is, I think, if to start any meditation is not to expect too much, to have a beginner's mind. Yeah. Sometimes when we expect too much, we might get disappointed if the meditation did not go so well. But these days, for myself, when it comes down to meditation, to me, it's just, I just do it. It becomes automatic. I don't expect too much anymore. Because I used to expect so much, and it got me nowhere, but more frustration. But these days, if I sit down, become quiet, I just do the meditation. Because if I expect too much, it becomes thinking, becomes doing. Then it's not meditation anymore. Meditation is basically learning to let go, and become peaceful, and just learn to relax. So. Yeah, so I think the most important thing is just do it without any expectation.
Yeah, it's also quite nice to think about it in a way that it is a daily-ish practice, because sometimes we get so hard on ourselves if we say, right, now I'm going to meditate for every day until the last breath I'm going to take. And then we skip one day and we really kind of beat ourselves up and go like, okay, that's okay, meditation practice out the window. So just practice daily-ish. And then when you are practicing, I also emphasized that in the interviews, when I was doing the first meditation, I encouraged you to really feel what has shifted at the end of the meditation. And that is basically what will give you the motivation, what will give you the understanding why we're doing this. And when you know why you're doing something, it's much, much easier to do it. Then it's not a must. Then it's actually a, I really want to do this. And even if I don't have that much time, good enough, you know. Even if I can't eat the whole bowl of whatever I like, even a little piece of it is really nice. So don't think of it, my practice, and I have to practice exactly that much, and start to compare yourself with what which teacher says and what your friends do. Just keep it natural and just keep doing it. And keep seeing the benefits that will propel you to do it more and more. And we've spoken also with some people today that have realized when that kind of happens, then the people around you, the work environment, your family starts to adjust to that as well. So the internal practice kind of starts to radiate out into your world, and your world starts to support what you're trying to do. So it kind of works together.
Sometimes also it's best not to set any goals. Like say I must sit for 1 hour or 2 hours. I think even 5 minutes is good enough. Because sometimes I find that some of my best meditation is when I don't expect too much. And I just sit when I feel like it. And even if it's a just only 5 minutes, it's good enough. But sometimes I find that it's not about how long you sit, or how consistent you are. If you need to let go and become peaceful, and if you sit down and relax, that maybe is the right time. So for me, I meditate if I need to. And if I can't have the time, I just leave it to the next day. Yep. Even 5 minutes is good enough. Because when you're very natural into meditation, sometimes it just take about half a minute for the mind to calm down, become very still. Yep, it's not about the quality. It's just learning the technique where you. It's like learning to drive a car. In the beginning, we're quite nervous, quite tense. But the more we drive our vehicle, the more we become natural driving. So we just jump in the car and we just drive down to town. Same with meditation. The more we practice, the easier it becomes, until it becomes second nature. So if it's 5 minutes or half an hour, it just becomes natural.
Very good. It's 10:02. We still have maybe 5 questions. You have enough energy? Yeah? Okay, carry on. Good. Meditation, or if you feel like you want to go and rest, please feel free. Yeah. Meditation practice versus wisdom from the suttas. Do you encourage lay Buddhists to get their own book knowledge, or should this be passed to laymen through Sangha? No. Go back and find out what is written in the books. We are very fortunate today that we do have good translations, and that we have scholars, for example, over in Bodhinyana Monastery who can actually tell you what those Pali words mean and where they come from. So the Buddha has always kind of encouraged us to go and find out for ourselves. Sometimes it might get a bit technical, but if you just go back to the suttas themselves, to the teachings that the Buddha has actually given, and not to the commentaries, it's usually quite common sense, quite vivid with similes, and understandable. So it shouldn't take, a rocket scientist to understand it. It takes a Pali scholar to translate it, but it doesn't take a rocket science to, a scientist to understand it. So please, yes, why not? But we're also telling some people in the interview, Ajahn Chah had this kind of nice simile where he said, the books are like desserts. So it's okay to have a bit of dessert, but don't overdo it. Don't just eat desserts. You will feel sick. So have the main meal, have the main course. And that is the practice. That is the meditation. That is the precepts. That is being kind, gentle. Yeah. And the books then kind of can sometimes help you to get insights or to kind of understand what has happened. Yeah. So both is good. Yeah. Just in the right amount.
Talking about books, it's true. I mean, Dharma practice is taking the medicine for the cure of the defilements. So it's best to take the cure instead of reading the manual or the consensus. Because if you read it, read the instruction or what's in the medicine, there's not much benefit. You must take the medicine.
Yeah, very good. Okay, you're one. Keep the microphone. How do you recommend dealing with people, for example, work colleagues who are aggressive or rude for no reason? Oh. You want to tell the story of the guy who hit his head?
His head?
Hit head, yeah, in the market? No?
I think maybe better.
Okay, well, I'm wired up here. Okay, sure. So it's quite a nice story. So there was this couple, and the wife was cooking something at home, and there were some eggs missing. So she told her husband, "Oh, please, can you go to the marketplace and get some eggs for me?" So he usually wouldn't do that, but it was the weekend and he had enough time. So he went down to the marketplace, and as soon as he entered the marketplace, there was this one guy. And he just came straight up to him and he started swearing at him for no reason. He called him all sorts of things that I'm not allowed to say as a monk. He told him he's a camel face or whatever. That's Ajahn Brahm's invention. And he just couldn't take it anymore. He turned around, came back home, and his wife said, "Oh, honey, you're early. That was really quick. Where are the eggs?" And he's like, "Look, I came to the marketplace and it's disgusting. This guy just came up to me and he just kept swearing at me for no reason." And she said, "Oh, yes, yes, that's Billy, you know. When he was a small boy, he fell and he hit his head, you know. He is not quite right up there. He does that to everyone, you know, it's fine." So, okay, can I please have the eggs then? And he said, "Okay, I'll go back." So he went back. He went back with a completely different mindset. The guy came straight up to him, started swearing at him for no apparent reason. But this time it was fine. He was like, "Oh yeah, you know, this poor guy, he hit his head." So he went up to the egg stall and he kept cursing at him, and he got his eggs and got back home and was at peace. So if something happens like that to you, that person might have hit their head. No, anger is actually temporary insanity. Also, greed and lust and all these other defilements. When we are under the sway of those defilements, we don't know what we're doing. As Jesus said, please forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. Yeah, we're out of our minds. We have lost touch with our heart. We need help. We need compassion. Or we need to just kind of be left alone and not be shouted up back.
Anyway, this is a bit more serious. Dealing with difficult people, it's not easy, it's very hard. Mm. Because sometimes, going back to Newbury, also here too, because I was a guest monk here, so I had to book in some people. Also, booking new people in Newbury too. And sometimes we find we have some guests that's running away from problems, relationship, or abusive family. So these are basically men and also ladies too. So when they come in, they stay, they almost are on edge. You can tell on their eyes. And if I a bit too serious, it can trigger those emotions easily. And they can be quite aggressive back. So I realized, okay, there's something wrong. There must be something underlining. So I just give a bit of distance, let them cool down. And because once a person is very aggressive, we don't show any aggression back. Sometimes, that's why the Buddha say we should practice compassion. When someone is suffering, we see their hurt, we feel their hurt, and we try to understand where they're coming from. So if I have a difficult guess, I try to understand where they're coming from. Then later on, when I show them compassion and kindness back, then they open up. So we have one guest, I'm not going to mention his name, in case he turn up here one day. His dad was very abusive. He used to beat him up. And I think his mom divorced his dad. Then later on, his brother committed suicide. So he came from a very dysfunctional and abusive family. So sometimes when we have guests that are staying there and they're a bit not themselves, sometimes you have to give them a lot of space and compassion. But sometimes you realize that they have a hard childhood. So it's their conditioning. So when things are not when they're not, we'll say, sane or out of control, it's just something is triggering out their defilements. So sometimes we have to learn to be careful and understand where they're coming from. But slowly, they do change and they do become good people. So I noticed in the monastery here and also in the monastery in Newbury, if we care for people that are suffering and give them the right condition and give them the right example, they will change and they will become good people. Like some of our supporters, you come in and go, oh man, not that guy again. You go, jeez. But after a while, when they come back, you give them kindness, they do change. And after a while, they become very good supporters. People do change. Yep. But the Buddha say, during the Buddhist time, there are some monastic that came from very bad background. Some are criminals. Some come from very poor families. But some of them actually become fully enlightened. So people have the mind to change. All you do is give them the right conditioning and the right programming, and people will change. Yep. So being a Buddhist monk for 10 years, actually 9 years, I've seen some of the worst people that came to the monastery. And after a few years, they became one of the nicest people I met. Quite caring, quite forgiving, and quite gentle.
Yeah, and also just make sure that the kindness goes both ways. So if you do need to protect yourself, if you do need to get help, please do that in a nice way, which is not hurting the other person or yourself. Okay. If you are contented, do you lose passion? Oh. Right. You can be passionately contented.
I mean, passion is something that if we quite contented, we have a passion for something, something that we really enjoy doing. Mm. So like all the monks, we train to let go and basically to renounce and live a simple life. But there are some monks that have a passion for some hobbies. Some monks, they like the suttas. They like reading the suttas. Some monks like to do a lot of work in the monastery, making things for the kutis, tables, chairs, donation box. Myself, I like fixing cars.
He does a very good job.
Yeah. Yeah. So I spend a lot of time fixing out all the old cars that is donated to the monastery.
In brackets, just monastery cars?
Monastery cars. So when I first came to the monastery, because as a layperson, I was a mechanic. So when I came to the monastery, my passion was into fixing cars. So we get a lot of old vehicles, and I tend to try and maintain it to my best of my abilities. So now we have about 10 vehicles in the monastery. We went from 3 vehicles to 10 vehicles. By the end of this year, we will have 11 vehicles. So one thing good thing about having that many vehicles is we can transfer them to other branch monastery once it's built. And also Ajahn Brahm says, it's good to accept dana from lay people because it gives the opportunity for them to make merit. But I do admit, having that skill to fix vehicle, that's one reason why we have a lot of vehicle these days. Yep. Yes. So having a passion for something wholesome is good.
Yeah, and also what just kind of came to my mind, we talked about really being devoted to something. And I do think that's kind of a passion there as well, isn't it?
Okay. My one, hey? If you try to practice mindfulness as much as possible, is it still necessary to meditate? Okay. If you try to practice mindfulness. We will be going to be talking about mindfulness on the fifth session there. But mindfulness is often wrongly understood. We often think mindfulness is something we do. Mindfulness is something which happens when we put in the right causes. So it's something that grows. It's a clarity. It's a stillness of mind. It's a happiness that arises when we put the right causes into place. And meditation is, it depends how you define meditation. But if you define meditation as stillness, I do think that, it is necessary. You can't develop mindfulness without stillness and gentleness there. Because otherwise it's just kind of like, I don't know, you're trying to force yourself into something. Almost there, eh?
Maybe a bit late, yeah.
Yeah, it's 9:07. As someone newish to practice, when I start to observe, experience nimittas, my mind startles, panics. Do you have any advice how to handle this? Yes, we have talked about this also. Nimittas, just to mention, are mental images of the mind. It's when we start to let go of the five senses, the mind often arises as something visual, and it's an experience that is unusual because we don't have it every day. So what often happens is there is two responses. There is either a fear or there is an excitement there. And it's good to learn to work with these things. And Ajahn tells us to program mindfulness. So we tell ourselves when we're going into the meditation, if something like that is going to arise, that we won't react in that way, because it's something the body just kind of does automatically. And we can kind of develop a habit to break that. Hope that helps. Yeah.
You see, when nimittas arise in the mind, is when the mind is very calm and quite peaceful, and we are basically withdrawing back from our five senses. So this form of a light will arise naturally. When it arises, a person will feel quite peaceful and calm and quite still. But sometimes it can be quite overwhelming when that arises, because it's something quite new. So for a person that have the experience arise for the first time, it's quite amazing. But if a practitioner would say get excited or scared, then the nimitta would disappear, will just fade away and vanish. Yep. So nimittas arise very strongly when our senses shut down or we become quite mindful. So it's something very natural. If you go to the internet and you look at near-death experience, a lot of people, when they pass away, not all, but most will see a nimitta. It's when they die or they have a serious car accident or have some kind of accident, when they move on to the past life and move away from this body, or they just actually pass, they just die temporarily, they always see this form of a light coming out. Sometimes really bright, sometimes you see visions and places. So the mind is forming another place. When someone passes away, you can check on the internet that a person's mind is very active for 7 minutes before he passes away. Sometimes it's a playback of the memory from now into they're quite young, just born. So nimittas are quite natural. So sometimes it's great if we can experience a nimitta arise. But most people will see it when they're passing away. So for Buddhist meditators, if we can calm and still the mind, then the mind will show itself naturally. Yep. So that's the advantage for a practitioner we have. We don't have to wait until we die. Because when we're dead, it's too late already. We can't do anything. So if we don't put in the right course and condition, the nimitta arise could be quite a scary nimitta. Because sometimes it all depends in our mind state. If we have a very happy mind, you see it's a nice nimitta. If we're living with a lot of fear and anger, it can arise a very scary nimitta. But the mind creates the condition for the next rebirth. So that's why we call this karma. Yep. I can't change it. No one can change it. It's basically we are responsible for our own karma. So you look at a lot of the people that have near-death experience, they always describe this vision or this light arising. So for us, we call that the nimittas, the nimitta in the mind.
I just kind of had a look at those two questions, and they're both dealing with day-to-day life, and I think I can weave them in a little bit later, tomorrow, and maybe in the last talk, because it is getting a bit late. So thank you for your attention. Thank you for a lovely day at Jhana Grove, and have a good rest. We shall see you tomorrow.